For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer of Longform, both of them. Hello, gentlemen.
Thanks for remembering my name this time.
Yeah, for once.
Well, I do my best.
Josh nice to Berlin see you guys.
Here. Yeah, it's always a party in here. You know, actually, I forgot. When I was in Mexico, I got some duty-free liquor, and I need to bring that in.
I got to tell you, man, you're really pushing the limits on forgot.
Yeah.
You're edging ever closer into keeping.
Yeah, I've been holding on to this duty-free liquor for about 3 weeks now, but it's going to be here, and it's going to get crazy at this podcast.
From what you told me, this week's interview could have really used some booze.
It was me and Jay Caspian Kang, who I was talking to, were in a self-deprecation contest, which I think he defeated me in, but he's a real interesting guy, and yeah, actually, I think it was one of my favorite people to talk to. I would have a beer with him.
Or an entire bottle of Jameson, which you're not going to share with us.
And we got a sponsor this week, Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. Thanks to them.
Here's Aaron and Jay.
Welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm here with Jay Caspian Kang. Welcome, Jay.
Hey, how's it going?
So I think the first story I really like remember seeing of yours was the New York Times Magazine story you did about the online kids online gambling.
Yeah, Daniel.
Huge money. And I think I went back and read some of your earlier stuff before that. And I know that you came out of an MFA program. At what point did you sort of start pushing for a career in writing?
I think I wanted to be a novelist. Sorry, I have a cold. From when I was a very young kid, probably yeah. From when I was like 10, and it never occurred to me to do anything else, including being like a journalist, especially not being like a internet content creator, you know, which is sort of what I think I do a lot of now.
You're the first person I've on the show who's self-described themselves as an internet content creator, although
I call myself a content farmer, but I thought that it would be too derisive to myself.
Right.
Maybe I should give myself a little more credit, but I only did it, you know, in private. I'll call myself a content farmer.
So prior to becoming a farmer, you were what point did you start working on the novel that you now have out?
Well, you know, when I was in the MFA program, I went right after college.
Yeah.
So I was 23, and then between 23 and about 27, I worked on one book, and you know, I just didn't really know how to work, and I was very.
When you say you didn't know how to work, in terms of self-discipline, you didn't know how to work?
No, I mean, I worked a lot, but I just didn't know how I was going to get to where I needed to go.
Yeah.
And so I think if I looked at the archives of that first book, there was probably like 2,800 pages or something like that, you know, of like content that was just original content and not even like re-edited content or like stuff like that. And there was no way that all that would sort of cohere into one book. And in the end, that's sort of what happened. Like, I just didn't know what to do with it. And then I decided to go to law school, like in 2009. I think, and as I was taking the LSAT, I got really depressed because, you know, I was taking the LSAT, and I wasn't even really doing well on the, I did really well on LSAT practice exams, and then I went and I took the LSAT in the game section, I had like a meltdown,
yeah,
like literal meltdown where I almost started crying, the girl next to me had to be like, are you okay? I was like, no, I can't figure this out, like, this is horrible, and then after that, I gave myself like a, I was like, all right, you're just going to, you know, like you've always wanted to be a fiction writer, you always want to be a novelist. So why don't you take 9 months and, you know, at the time I was collecting unemployment from the state of California.
Yeah.
And like my unemployment ran out in 9 months. So I wrote this novel in 9 months. And and then around that same time when I was taking breaks from the novel, I just started communicating a bit with a guy I know from high school who ran the Free Darko blog.
Yeah.
He was actually like my high school newspaper editor.
And, what's that guy's name?
Like Nathaniel Friedman.
Oh, Free Darko himself.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So he and I went to the same high school.
Yeah.
North Carolina. And the idea of writing on the internet for the first time sort of occurred to me. I don't know why it didn't occur to me before, but you know, I wrote a piece about Jeremy Lin when Jeremy was a junior in college at Harvard. And, you know, I think it was received better than I thought it would be. And I sort of started to feel that like warm glow that everyone feels at some point where like the internet is agreeing with you. And then I slowly started doing more, churning out more content for the internet. And
you wrote a piece for the Morning News.
Yeah.
Also about gambling, your own gambling addictions. At what point in this trajectory did that piece come out? That was what, 2010?
I wrote that piece. Yeah, I wrote that piece when I was really young.
Yeah.
I think I wrote it when I was 24, 25. And I didn't know what to do with it because at that time I really just like, you know, the idea of a career was sort of silly to me. Mm-hmm. I was still like caught up in trying to be like a more elegant beatnik or something, you know.
Yeah.
Like I didn't want to like become like a corporate writer.
What,
which is ironic.
How did you support so between 23 and 27 you were writing a 28,000 page novel and some pieces that you didn't publish. How are you supporting yourself during this period?
I was a teacher at private high schools in California.
What subject?
English. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I thought I'd be doing with my life, actually. That was like, I think that was the most likely thing that I would have ended up doing with my life.
Being a high school English teacher?
Being a private school English teacher.
It's good and bad. It's good in that it doesn't take the psychic toll on you, I think, that teaching at a public high school does, because the kids are going to be fine. And at the same time, the fact that it doesn't take like that psychic toll makes you feel like a horrible person, you know, at least it did for me. And that, you know, if you grow up and you have like vaguely Marxist ideas and you want to affect the world in certain ways. And here you are like working for like the worst institution in terms of like splitting people up in terms of haves and have nots at like a impressionable age. And you're teaching them all this sort of stuff that, you know, that they use to sort of distance themselves from other kids who don't have the same like quality of education. And you just feel like shit doing it, you know? I felt like shit. I'm sure that some people are much better at it and that they've committed themselves to it in a way that makes sense to them. But I always felt shit.
So at this point of time, you were a unpublished private school English teacher with Marxist views and a gambling problem.
Somewhat Marxist views, yeah.
were you spending a lot of time gambling during this period?
Yeah.
Gambling is kind of a California thing.
40 to 50 hours a week, probably.
I'm from California, and like, yeah, that would be like, you would be like par for people I know from California, but I always meet people in New York who don't know the rules of poker.
Well, L.A., are you from L.A.?
I'm from Berkeley.
Oh, from Berkeley. Yeah, I mean, you know, like in, what is that town called? The one next to Berkeley on 580. Emeryville.
Emeryville.
So in Emeryville, there's a card room.
Oaks card room.
The Oaks card room.
I spent some time there.
Yeah. San Francisco, South San Francisco, and Colma, there's like the Lucky Chances.
Yeah.
And in L.A., they're everywhere. And so like...
do you need like a gambling permit to open one of these places? For people who are listening, these are like, I think they kind of really only exist in California. They're literally just a big room where you can play cards. And they could be everything from a place with a buffet and to like, I've been to ones in like Sonoma that are like a veterans hall that they occasionally have sandwiches at. Like you just need a room to have one.
It's like old. people have been playing at the Commerce, I think, and at the Bicycle Casino for generations down there. I don't know. It is a lot more part of the lifestyle. I just think there's so many immigrants in LA who come from sort of fatalistic countries. So like you got a lot of, you know, a lot of people who dealt with a lot of turmoil in their home countries. So you have a lot of Vietnamese, Koreans, you know, and Armenians.
Yeah.
And Israelis in LA. And they're all like, you know, like the gambling problems within those people are just like horrendous. Right. And so, those rooms are always full, always full, you know, and always sort of split up between racial groups. So,
yeah,
you know, like Koreans are thought to be crazy, you know,
thought,
like,
only so, thought to be
only thought to be. So if there's like, if there's a table that's slow,
yeah,
the people will be like, can you just please bring a Korean person to, you know, a Korean guy to come play here? I don't know. I spent like 4 years in those places in LA, in California. And I think I got an education in something. Yeah. I don't know if it was a particularly great education, but, you know, like, it was nice to not... I think I was there in part because, like, I was so resistant to the demographic of people that I had gone to college and graduate school with. And you know, like, it made no sense to me. I was, like, such a... I really hated... like, I got kicked out of college twice. I really didn't like being in an MFA program. And I think I was just sort of like so aimlessly rebellious that I was willing to hang out anywhere except around people who, you know, like read the New Yorker and sort of like aspired to be writers.
So what in sort of, while you're working on this novel, you did this piece about your own gambling. Was that the first time you'd written about yourself in a nonfiction sense?
No, you know, I wrote an essay that we ultimately published on Grantland about Ichiro Suzuki.
Yeah.
I wrote that like when I was like 22 or something, I think.
Have you written anything in the last couple of years? Or are you just mining things you wrote while you're unemployed in your 20s?
If there was more, I'd be writing. It would be out there, I'll tell you that much. So that was the first real personal essay I wrote. I really like my two heroes in terms of nonfiction are James Baldwin, like Joan Didion. Like those are the two people who I go back and read several times a year. They're the two writers who I think, you know, sort of wrote most forcefully about what was happening in the 20th century. And you know, it's like I try to spy, like those pieces really sort of, I think, were really, and maybe even in an embarrassing way, or like very aspirational towards the type of writing that James Baldwin and Joan Didion did about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd like to do a lot more of that, but it's a little bit hard. Like, I feel like I'm caught up in this thing where, like, you know, like I said, like you create content for the internet,
yeah,
and you have to follow the internet, and there's no time for like doing anything that requires any sort of, or even warrants self-reflection. You know, like I don't need to reflect about reading Twitter and like following some, you know, like following like something that happens on Twitter or like Harlem Shake videos. Like there's no reflection. And I mean, people do write personal reflections on those things, and you know, they're always so stupid. And like, it's not, I don't know. I guess it's just difficult to be a content creator and to write something that's like reflective, I think, in a way that's very sincere and is not sort of this idea that you are going to write something reflective and sincere about something that you know is going to be read a lot because it's what's being discussed right now.
Is the limitation how long it takes to do something like that, or is it like, have you shifted sort of, is your brain no longer?
Yeah, I think it's a brain thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't sort of like agonize over things in the same way. And I think that if you're a fiction writer, like that's all you do, because like the process is actually just sort of like borderline torturous.
Yeah.
And you like little things that happen in your life, because your entire life consists of sitting by yourself with like no sort of exterior stimulation, start to take on like a lot more meaning. So you become more observant. Mm-hmm. Like, so like I remember I would just go to the same coffee shop that had no wireless in San Francisco. And after a certain point, I could tell that like, I was more observant than I had been before. That never happens now, you know? Like, it's like, I'm like, if anything, like, I've become 10% as observant as I was before. And my brain has become really wired differently, you know? Like, I can, Maybe I think it's all sort of, you know.
Isn't that happening to everyone now though, or is there like some other class of people that we don't like? I feel like that. I don't know anyone who is not at least subject to some of that
gravity. Yeah, I think everybody. But I mean, that's what like Royce White said, right? On our talked to like Chuck Klosterman on our site.
Yeah,
they're like it's sort of like a collective mental illness. I thought that was like the most interesting thing he said.
I liked his justification for why everyone in the NBA has like a mood disorder is everyone smokes weed.
That was that was the part I couldn't ride with Royce on. He's so anti-weed.
Yeah, yeah. I was the same thing. I was like, wait, on, dude. Wait, dudes in the NBA smoke weed? So for you, I mean, the internet has brought you a lot of new things. You're a writer who's the internet has brought a lot of attention to. What was sort of the first piece that got a big response that you did? I feel like, I mean, that morning news story,
it was a morning news piece. Yeah. I still think that's like the piece. I don't know. I mean, in terms of traffic numbers, like, you know, like the morning news is never going to get as much traffic as Grantland.
Right. How did that piece end up at the morning news?
I read something from Anthony Doerr, who was a professor at Bowdoin, which is where I went to college. And I was in that sort of mind state after having sort of blown the LSAT that like, I just have to like get everything out there that I've written.
Yeah.
So that in 5 years, if I'm like looking for a job as a lawyer and really unhappy, that like, I can at least say like, I wasn't just sort of sitting in paralysis, not sending anything out the way I had been for like 5-6 years before, you know?
Yeah. That's a feeling I can very much identify with.
I think every writer can.
Were you literally not sending anything out that you were writing?
Yeah, nothing. Yeah. And you know, like I look back on it now, I mean, I went and talked at Bowdoin last week and this girl from the college newspaper interviewed me. And I went back and I read some of my columns from back then. And I was like, you know, like, I don't know. I think my writing back then was like somehow better. And like, and even during that period where I was really paralyzed, I felt like my writing, when I look back and read that stuff, like it has a certain, like, there's not that this sort of like superstructure placed over it where the person writing it is aware of how the internet is going to react to what he's writing.
Right.
And now everything I write, even though I try very hard to not have this happen, like everything I write is like, you know, like there's always a sort of chattering on in my head about how the internet is going to react to what I'm writing.
Interesting.
So, I don't know how to like get rid of that sort of constant chatter.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think about in terms of some of the people you cited, because it's not like, Joan Didion was writing in a vacuum or anything. She's writing for like a gigantic and probably fairly vocal audience. But it is true that at that point in time, like, you know, talking about someone's writing involved writing a letter that you had to put a stamp on and drop in the mail, which is like a very different interchange. Do you hear a lot from the people who read your stuff on Grantland?
Yeah, like their Twitter.
Yeah.
Does
it bug you out?
No, I've gotten used to it. I guess, I mean, I don't mean to say any of this to complain about it or say that there's like some sort of death of print journalism and that we're all going to become like content farmers, but it's very difficult. I guess it's just one of these things that I've noticed is that even something as simple as a decision of whether or not to put the actual number of Facebook likes at the bottom of the page and whether to hide that, it really changes the way that writers engage with the text and with writing the piece. And I mean, I know this just from my experience as an editor at Grantland, where some of the writers that I had who are, you know, wonderful writers who I think really do write without this stuff in mind, they would sort of, you could see them obsessing in the same way that I did about whether or not their number was big enough, you know? And that the idea that in the end, like where you spent like a lot of time and your piece gets like 430 likes or something like that, you know, which is a good number, but then somebody else just comes along and just slaps something down, and because it's a hot topic it goes to like 25,000,
right?
Like it's a difficult thing to contend with. And I think it's, you know, I if it was up to me, Like, I think that we would get rid of all that sort of stuff on Grantland. Like, we would stop having visible metrics. And the only reasoning would not be because, you know, we're too, like, high-minded to, like, sort of participate in that economy.
Yep.
But more because I think it's a better place for writers to have as much of that stripped out of their daily process as possible.
What brought you to Grantland in the first place? I mean, they sort of assembled this kind of Yankees-style roster of journalists, and I don't really know that much about how that all unfolded, but you got an email one day. They were like, hey, you want to go write for this new ESPN Bill Simmons site?
Yeah. I had, like, a very crazy 2 months. So I went with my girlfriend to Cambodia for like 2.5 months in, I think it was 2010, December. And then my novel sold while I was there. And then I got, because of the morning news piece, I got some like magazine opportunities all on sort of the same day while I was at Angkor Wat. And then right after that, I got an email from Bill and asking if I wanted to work on this thing. And I had heard about it because there had been some rumors, you know, because he had already hired Katie Baker, yep, and he had already hired Molly and Chris Ryan. And, you know, like, I am of the age and went to a school in New England and am interested in sports.
You felt like you had been profiled already?
Well, I grew up, no, it wasn't that. I just grew up, like, really love, like, yeah, when I was in college, it sounds like a cliche at this point, but we really did print out Bill's columns and read them and talk about them, you know. And
I unfortunately, I'll work with someone who has the same attitude as you.
So it's like, it was sort of, it's like mindless blind fanboydom, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was sort of powerless, and I guess, you know, I certainly don't regret the decision. So but yeah, it was like,
have you had to, I mean, in terms of working in the site, I know you'd done some sports related stuff, but you're doing some pretty like deep, heavy sports journalism. Did you have to sort of educate yourself as a sports journalist?
I mean, as a journalist, period.
Yeah. What was that like? What was that process of becoming a real journalist like?
I'm still going through it.
Yeah.
My goal for this year was like, I was like, all right, you have, you know, like, I think I was like, okay, so like the things that you wanted to accomplish when you were a kid, like publish a novel, like you did. And like, now it's just about like figuring out how to continue in the public sphere. And I just couldn't like see myself just writing essays without any sort of reporting base. So this year I just decided to try and become a better reporter. So all the pieces that I've been doing are all like trying to do some different aspect of reporting that I feel like I need to work on.
And that New York Times piece you did about online gambling, you went and followed these very young dudes who are moving millions of dollars in online gambling sites, which I think are largely gone now, right?
They're coming back this year.
So let's just take that story for example. What was your entry point for that story? How did you get hooked up with them?
That was my first reporting assignment ever. Like, I didn't come up, I didn't have any internships or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so I think I was mostly going off of what I had seen on TV and in movies.
Yeah.
And it just, I guess for that piece, it was okay because I didn't really need to ask him any questions because the subject was so, at least to me, interesting on his own. You know, like, he was a really strange kid. He had very, very complicated ideas about like the actual value of money versus like the actual value of games, you know. He was really weird about things, like, you know, like he lived in Orlando and he was talking about how he only had like $6 million and that to comfortably buy a house in like Orlando, you need $10 million, you know? And I was like, I'm pretty sure Derek Jeter bought a mansion around Orlando for about $6 million. So I don't know what type of house you live in. Like, right now you live in a condo in Orlando and it sucks, you know? So like, he had no real concept of money. And he gave me all this access because, you know, he's just a kid.
How did you find him in the first place?
I read a lot of stuff online, and then when that gambling piece came out, the personal essay in the morning news, a lot of people contacted me. A lot of professional poker players contacted me. I got a lot of emails from guys who are pretty famous who are just like, I've done the same thing. Like those sort of head games you play with yourself where you just like are screaming at yourself that you're a horrible degenerate. And then it becomes funny to you, you know, because you can't leave and you're just pissing away all your money. And you just started giggling to yourself, like, you know, like, I think that's a universal experience for degenerate gamblers. So a lot of the guys, I think, somehow found it and wrote to me. So through those contacts, I found, like, all the contact information for Daniel.
I mean, is part of you saying at this point, holy shit, I'm doing a story for New York Times Magazine, I have no idea what I'm doing? Or are you coming into this with a high level of confidence?
No, definitely the former. I guess it still all feels very unreal, you know, like you call somebody if you're working on one of the, a piece for them and you say like, you know, oh, I'm calling for like the New York Times. And it felt very unreal to me. And, you know, like very quickly, it, you know, I came up against the idea that, no, this is actually real. And for this to be real, like you have to really become a better reporter. So like I'm still working through that.
I mean, you've sort of talked about the way that moving away from that fiction writer's life of going to a coffee shop without wireless to the content farmer life has sort of turned you off to some of your skills of observation. Do you feel like you've picked up other things as a writer along the way? I mean,
I'm a lot faster.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to write between 300, 500 words a day maximum. I don't know. I mean, there are days where I write 4,000 words, you know.
Do you have a quota of what you do, like at Grantland? Are you like on the tether? But you're just going for it now.
I don't know, because it's like I think I'm trying to bridge ambition with what I actually want to do, and I think I don't know if this is true or not, but you know, in my opinion, if you want to write primarily on the internet and you want to have a big audience and you want to be able to make money in a way that only a very, very few amount of people are making money writing on the internet, you got to be very consistent with your output. Like people have to be able to come to your website to find you like a couple times a week, you know, especially unless you have a massive audience already that grew up with you. Like you've got to be able to like keep it coming. And, you know, when I started, I think, at Grantland, like I, you know, that made sense to me. And I think that it was always this internal struggle between that desire and the desire to go back to like my fiction writing process, where I felt like I was producing better sentences, but for nobody, you know, and that.
I mean, is there anywhere in between there in terms of doing like longer nonfiction features and stuff? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, you guys like clearly think so, right? Like that there's some sort of medium.
I mean, that's certainly, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of being a writer on the internet, because everyone who's writing is basically a writer on the internet now. I mean, even the most venerable print magazines, really, like when you look at the numbers, they're internet magazines that happen to produce a small print edition, which pays for everything. Yeah. But there's still a much, much larger audience on the internet. So, yeah, I mean, when I look at the numbers that are for hit big long stories on the internet, it seems actually like the most, in some ways, it's some of the most read content out there. Certainly for magazines like, I mean, New Yorker, I think that Scientology, that Lawrence Wright's piece, was like that was their biggest online story ever or whatever. Yeah. It's most people read of any New Yorker story. But Grantland does stuff a lot, like a lot of that. You've done a few sort of bigger feature pieces for Grantland. Do you take off from doing the twice a week posts while you're doing these bigger features?
I think within internally, we just had like one thing that we're working on, and one thing that I think everyone on the internet is working on is trying to figure out like where, you know, that medium balance like you talked about. For me personally, I want to do those sorts of long reported features, and I think it's just like trying to figure out a way to craft it so that it can be consumed online without people looking down and being like, oh my God, this thing is like paginated, so I'm not going to read it.
What interests you as a writer? Like what gets you excited in terms of story? What's a story that gets you excited?
Crime.
Crime.
Yeah. Crime. And you know, like people acting very irrationally, I guess, you know, like when people, which usually goes with crime stories. And sort of these are people who try and exist outside of the law. And so like, you know, like the Christopher Dorner story in LA was like, I mean, that was riveting. Like I spent all day sitting in front of the TV for like 3 days for that. Like, you know, like those types of stories, stories that are about like people who like try and go rogue and sort of break off from society and do so in these sort of grand ways. You know, like, I mean, the best example of all that are all, you know, almost every single one of the mass shooters last year was this person like that, you know, like somebody who spent a lot of time or who spent a lot of time feeling very alienated from society and being eventually pushed into or feeling that they were pushed into a corner that they couldn't get out of. And that the only way that they could get out of this corner and sort of like actually like say, you know, like give the middle finger to society was to go out and shoot a whole bunch of random people. I don't know, like those, I guess those are stories.
You wrote about the Virginia Tech shooter, right?
Yeah, that was my novel.
Right. Well, you wrote about the connection between the sort of incidental connection between the Virginia Tech shooter and a character in your novel.
Yeah. The Virginia Tech thing was about, I was just very interested about how my own reaction to Virginia Tech. When it happened, I felt it was like the first time that I really sort of came to grips with, you know, my ethnicity, which is crazy because I was like 20 something, you know, but not in a way that was like sort of collegiate or like appreciative, you know, or even like some guy. I grew up in North Carolina. So there were plenty of racist people who would make me aware that I was not white. But, you know, like that's like not visceral. Like you get pissed off and you're just like, fuck you. And maybe you feel bad a little bit. But like, you know, when Virginia Tech happened, like it was like the first real like, oh, shit, like I am like this is different. Like this is somehow molding my identity as like a Korean dude a lot differently. And, you know, like it's making me feel all these sorts of wonder, all this shit about my own family, my own like people growing up. And it sort of made me feel bonded with other Korean dudes who have like bad tempers or something like that in a way that it really shouldn't have, but still did, you know? And so I wanted to write a novel sort of out of that sense. And I don't know, I think I still write, you know, I always want to write about these school shootings when they happen, but it's tough.
But I find it interesting, one thing you said, which is that the internet has made you more self-aware and more concerned about people's reactions to your writing, but it almost seems like a bit of a sort of a paradox, because your writing is by nature not autobiographical, is not the right word, but your writing is a lot about, you've written a lot about Lin, you've written about Ichiro, you write about Asian American stuff, and you write about sort of gambling, things that really cross the paths of your own life. Do you draw a distinction between that kind of self-awareness and the self-awareness that the internet promotes?
Yeah, definitely. They're not the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would call myself self-aware for writing those pieces. But I think that there's like a prettier version of navel gazing.
Yeah.
And I think that I was probably doing that like at my best, you know, like I still think that the gambling essay I wrote for Rosecrans at the Morning News, probably, I think it's still like the thing I'm proudest of that's in print. Like, and that Ichiro essay, I still think is the best thing I've written for Grantland. And so it's, you know, interestingly enough, both of those things were written way before I ever considered an internet writing career.
Yeah. Well, they're also they're things that they're not self-aware. They're things that, you need a certain knowledge to write. You can't write that piece about gambling without having gambled yourself. Yeah. They're not detached and they're not reported in that way. Do you think about trying, I mean, are you out of that kind of material now, or like, is that what's happening?
I'm out.
Tapped out.
I'm tapped out. I mean, I spent so much time when I was a kid gambling and, you know, like doing drugs, running around.
Yeah.
But I didn't do it in an interesting way, enough way where it could like be eons of material, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think at some point I'll write a essay about, going to raves when I was in college because I went to a lot of raves. But then I read that Zadie Smith piece about going to a rave, and I was like, oh my God, she beat me to it, you know? Like, I had a similar bathroom drug experience that she had, you know? And I was like, I can't write. And I had always wanted to write about it. And I had even sketched it out and written some of the sentences. And then I read that. I was like, oh, you know, she's still, like, I can't do the raves anymore. So what am I going to do? As that, you know, people know, like, writing is like more than a full-time job. I think that's why I really appreciate being able to go out and do these reported pieces, because they give me experiences that I wouldn't have if I was sitting at home. Like, when I'm sitting at home and sort of churning content, like, I feel like I really don't like this sort of daily process of my life, which is a lot of Googling and a lot of like Twitter. Yeah. And a lot of sort of like obsessing over, like, you know, metrics of success.
Let's talk about that, because you're an editor of Grantland. So you're also, I assume, involved in commissioning other pieces.
I was, that, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you're not anymore, though.
I think by title I'm still, but like I am now more focused on writing features. So I don't go in the office as much.
But at a certain point, you were responsible.
At the beginning, yeah.
Some of the editorial voice.
It was me and Lane Brown and Dan Fearman. It was just three people.
Yeah. So there's this kind of sensibility to Grantland that's, I would say, sort of at the intersection of pop culture, sports, and this unnamed third realm that I would call, like, shit the internet likes.
Yeah.
And that sort of falls under the pop culture, but it's not necessarily traditional pop culture. It's internet. It's pop culture of today.
Which, so you mean like reposting really popular memes and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. And commenting on them, yep. And talking about internet videos and that kind of stuff. And it's a very developed voice that goes into it. But from what you're saying, it seems like not necessarily like the Jay Kang voice exactly. It's like a external voice to you. When you look at writers like Bill Simmons and like Chuck Klosterman, who've developed this very sort of elaborate pop culture vocabulary, is that something that you sort of attracted to as a writer yourself, or you're trying to get away from?
I'll just put it this way: like, until I started working at Grantland, I had never once watched the Oscars.
Yeah,
never once, you know. And the Grammys, like, I really didn't know what the like. I just thought, like, at some point somebody gives, like, you know, Nelly Furtado Award, I guess.
Yeah.
I was just really a dinosaur about music. Like, I just liked all the rap music I grew up with in the 90s and never developed musical taste past that. I really respect what those guys do.
Yeah.
And I understand that it is like it's like this massive ability to process all this information, you know, like, so, like, I've never met people in my life, honestly, who are better at processing things than Chuck and Bill. Like, they just are, you know, things go in. And then, you know, like, there's just sort of, like, literate thing that comes out. I personally just can't do that. Like, I did it. I wrote something for Corey on the All, like, the best divas of all time. That was sort of the piece that got me hired at Grantland. And I think it was one of the pieces that sort of, you know, like, it did well there, and yeah. And like, it was a piece that was a piece that sort of convinced me that I should keep writing on the internet, because I thought it was funny how people reacted well to it, and I, you know, for the first time I felt like very loved on the internet. So I
why can't you just accept the love of the internet, Jay?
It's not that. It's just that, like, that thing took me like 4 weeks to write, you know. And that's way too long for like a normal. Like, I, you know, like, I think I could do that. Like, I could sort of disappear for a long time and come out with one thing every few months that did process some sort of form of pop culture in that sort of way. But I can't do the daily stuff that happens. Like, I don't think I could write a weekly television column in the way that Andy does.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not because I don't watch TV. I watch a ton of TV, but I just don't have the gift of processing it into like sort of a consumable and interesting point, you know. Like, for me, it's just like, oh, that person's ugly, or like, I hate that guy, or like, you know, like, that would be my TV column. Like,
well, a lot of that writing, I think, tries to put the character above all, right? It's a form of sports writing that is not as concerned with who is going to win championships as it is with the personalities and characters and sort of putting a pop star and an athlete sort of in the same, treating them the same, putting them in the same article on this, in the same sort of level. And it seems to me that in your writing and the people that you chose to profile, you're sort of on the periphery of sports, but you pick people like a gambling star who's the opposite of a personality, the opposite of a character that you can easily identify with. They're fringe characters, really.
Yeah, that's an access question, right? Like writing NBA profiles, NFL profiles are almost impossible because anywhere you go, there's going to be a PR guy sitting with you. You get like 10 minutes, you know? I wrote these sort of, and to deal with that problem last year, I wrote a lot of these sort of half essay, half profile pieces. We call them person of interest. So I would go to the Bay Area and I would spend 10 minutes with Kwame Brown.
Yeah.
And I'll get like four quotes from Kwame Brown and then I have to craft an essay around it. And the four quotes were just like boilerplate, you know?
Yeah. I do it for God.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting though, because there's a lot of, I mean, you're, in some ways, part of you're part of one of the bigger, if you trace it up to the parent company, one of the bigger sports outfits in the world. I'm sure there's like a lot of young aspiring sports writers listening, maybe who imagine that there is some sort of a greater opportunity. But even at your level, you're only getting 10 minutes with Kwame Brown.
For me, yeah. I mean, I'm sure if I don't know if anyone would get more than a half hour with Kwame Brown.
Yeah.
Which is why in recent months or like this past year, I've really started doing boxing because boxing is like access all the time, you know, like, and the guys don't have publicists and they're just sort of, they're all like thoroughly entertaining people. You know, all of them came from like every single one of them came from nothing, you know, and they're all living this very, very weird life where they have just become famous. They still don't really have any money, but, you know, like, here's a reporter from ESPN Grantland who wants to spend 2 days with them, and they all say yes, you know? So, like...
Would you say that your ideal profile subject is anyone who, like, lives in a shitty condo with a bunch of their friends?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And has somehow sort of crafted a persona for... Or, like, some sort of incalculable and yet, like, very sort of... anonymous success for them. Like, yeah. Daniel, like, I remember the kid who played online poker. I sat next to him and there was a hand. I think he lost like $800,000. I was like, oh my God. He didn't blink, you know? I just find like those types of scenes you can't get, I don't think, if you spend it with really famous professional athletes. I thought Wright's piece on Michael Jordan at 50 was pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, not pretty good. I thought it was very, very good. And, you know, it was very, very good, in part because Wright, you know, I think is like a very, very good reporter. But I also think that it was like a level of access that was totally unexpected, right?
So, the whole time I was reading, I was like, who let you do this?
Yeah, you know, like that's one of the things I think I've been learning is sometimes if you just sit there, they forget that you're there.
Yeah,
and then so they forget to like get rid of you. You know, I mean. I'm very quiet and I try not to ask them a lot of questions. I don't know if that's the right approach or not, but it's an approach that works for me. And I generally just go in and I have like 6 to 10 questions that I want to ask them, but they're more like broad subject area types of things. And I just generally just observe. Cause I just feel like because I'm a fiction writer, you know, like the story will tell itself through the narrative of like the person's movement throughout their daily life, right? So with Daniel in that Times piece, it was because, you know, like his daily life was just sitting in front of a computer and then while like these numbers went way up and way down. And that was, I felt like showing that through scene was more interesting than just asking him, so what's it feel like to lose $800,000? Because, you know, he's just gonna be like, I don't know, like, you know. Yeah. So I try and do that with all the pieces, I guess. And I try not to rely on like quotes ever because I just think that people get really uncomfortable when you like shove a recorder in their face and ask them a bunch of questions. But again, like, you know, this is something I'm really, really learning for the first time now. And so I'm sure there are some reporters out there who have better strategies than I do.
Are you going to write another novel?
Yeah. Soon, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got like an idea, and I don't. I think I'm in a good place now because with writing fiction, I haven't written a word of fiction in 2 years. And before I used to do it every day, and I always thought I would come back to it. But then over the past 6 months, I started to become really afraid that I would never come back to it, and that that I would, you know, because it's, you know, the way that it is, you just get a much more reliable paycheck and a much more reliable readership and response. And you feel much more relevant doing journalism.
Yeah.
Or even like trolling Beyonce, you know? Like,
yeah.
And so I just could never think, I was like, all right, when I get time, I'm going to write a novel. When I get time, I'm going to write a novel. And it dawned on me that like, I really just had to make time and not, you know, like, I still don't know how I'm going to do that, but pretty soon I think I'm going to figure out a way to make time.
I mean, I think some people actually be interested in this. Like, what's your day-to-day life like as an internet content farmer? Give me a day in your life.
Man. I mean, when it was busy.
Yeah.
Like when I was like editing posts and writing posts.
Yeah.
I would get up at like 5:30 because it's West Coast. You have to post by 9. I would start editing content then, you know, like at like 6 a.m. on good days when I was like on top of stuff, I would send it off to like the copy desk. And then you just like sit doing that from 5:30, like 10:30. And then around 10:30, like you would take a short break. And then, you know, by that point, you've probably like responded to like 40, 50 emails. And then we would drive into the office and all meet in the office and do the same thing in the office till like 3. And then at 3 o'clock on the West Coast, our day was over. And then we would have like meetings to sort of plan the next content. And then you go home around like 7. But that was like when we had a full staff and like workload was reasonable. At the very beginning, when it was just me, Lane, and Dan, and this kid Robert Mays, who was like sort of our editorial assistant, we called him like our do everything guy, and Bill, you know, like we work, I don't know, like 16 hours in an office down in downtown LA, like 20 hours sometimes, you know, like it was an insane amount of work.
Was that gratifying in any way?
It was exciting.
Yeah.
It was really exciting. I think like starting a website, even I guess a cynical person would be like, of course, starting a website with those writers and ESPN's money.
Yeah.
Like it's going to be like, it's going to work. But it, you know, like the excitement you feel is not, it's not like, you're not like, cause you don't get paid. So it's not like, oh man, all this traffic is coming in.
Yeah.
Like I'm making money. It's just exciting to see something sort of come into creation and people react to it. Positive, negative. It was great. Like I think like working on a small team, like very passionately and hard for a project that you believe in is, you know, like, I don't know. I can't think of a better way to spend my time.
Seems like a good note to end on. Jay Kang, thank you very much. Jay Caspian Kang.
No, you can just call me Jay Kang. It's okay.
Jay Caspian Kang, thank you very much for coming in on short notice while you're out reporting on your trip. We'll be here next week. The editor was Lauren Kirchner. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. Our sponsor this week is Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. I will see you soon.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.